My name is Cindy Sickler, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Cindy.
And it's truly by the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and really great sponsorship. I've been sober since October the 17th of 1986. And I'm very, very honored to be here. I really want to thank the committee for asking me to speak. You get to hear the other half of the story on Sunday. And it really is a privilege and an honor to be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my first time for speaking at a large conference. And I'm scared, I'm nervous, and all those things that are going on my insides. And the first thing I did yesterday morning was when I called my sponsor, which check-in time, and I said, okay, what do I say? And she goes, for God's sakes, don't be profound. So I thought, okay, I'm done. And I know that it's not about being profound, it's about being who I am. And I really am an alcoholic. And I really want to thank Jan and Glenn for being our hosts. It's really terrific to get to meet people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because we are very special people. We've come a long way, and we have a long way to go, and it's really neat to get to meet people. I was born in Minnesota, raised in Washington State, transplanted to Southern California, and now live in Omaha, Nebraska. Does that tell you anything about geographics? I moved around a lot. I was only 5 months old when we moved to Washington, and we moved numerous times in Washington State. But when I turned 16, my parents offered me the use of their car, which became my car, because they had their cars. But I got to share mine. But on the weekends, it was my car, and so the first weekend after I turned 16, it was the car keys and a six-pack. That's where I went. And from the weekend after that, it graduated to a 12-pack because there was not enough in a 6-pack. And then the week after that, it was a case. And then it got to be the point where there was not a big enough back seat, and it looked rather obvious to carry cases of beer around in the back seat of a little Chevy Nova 1961, one of those hard tops, you know, bright red, stood out in a crowd. So I graduated to the fifth of McNaughton's underneath the front seat. And that was in a matter of a month. I was a weekend drunk at that period of time. And I don't remember much about my junior, senior year. It kind of got lost somewhere in the fog. And my life really was wrapped around drinking. I could not get enough. There was never enough, and I always felt less than. I didn't run around with the in crowd. I was more of the out crowd. I refer to myself as the class drunk. There was about five of us that drank together, and that's what we did from Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And that pattern of drinking played out for the rest of my drinking career. I would only drink on the weekends. Then the weekends began to happen on Thursdays. Then it went to Wednesdays, and then I'd start on Tuesdays because that was my bowling night, so the only way I could bowl was to be drunk, so that was the way that it went. But I was not a daily drinker. I was a periodic drunk. But one thing that happened for me that I didn't realize happened all the time was when I had the first drink, I couldn't quit drinking. It didn't compute. My idea was that it was never to have the drink, it was always to get drunk. That's the way that it was with me. I didn't like the way I felt. I didn't like the way I looked. I didn't like the way who I was with the people I was with. I had to be different. I was never okay with me. I've also had a weight problem since I was 9. I've done this with my weight. And when I was 13, my mom took me to a diet doctor and gave me those wonderful little white pills. Yes! I would get up at 11 o'clock in the morning, take one of those little pills, and would go to bed at 2 o'clock at night. You know, that's the way it was. That's how it affected me. But I sure dropped it. In 6 weeks, I was down to what I really wanted to be. And from that point to this point, I still do this. But my life always has evolved around drinking. In fact, when I was a senior in high school, I found a hymn. I had lots of hymns, but I really found the hymn this time. And I was 17, and he asked me to marry him, and I said, yeah, sure. He was in the Navy, stationed aboard ship, living in San Diego. So I decided I was going to go to school, so I graduated from high school, and we became engaged, and I went off to business college because normal college was not going to be enough for me. Besides, I needed to follow in my mother's footsteps, which was computers and secretarial, and that's how I viewed myself. That was the only kind of job that I could get. And then what transpired is that I had my car stolen. I thought, oh, must be an omen. I think I'll quit and get married. So that's what I did. I quit school, got married. That was a good idea. Moved all the way to San Diego, California. And that was one of those really strange marriages. Because we'd been married for 2 weeks, and all of a sudden he didn't come home. And I knew he wasn't out on ops, but he didn't come home. And we didn't have a phone. So at about 4 o'clock in the morning, Monday morning, I heard somebody banging on the front door of the apartment, and I thought, who would that be? I wonder if it's him. And sure enough, well, he ended up in the brig, bread and water for the 4 days, because he had a lousy attitude. Now, you put two people with a lousy attitude together, and what do you get? Yeah, that's exactly. We lived in a very violent relationship. And we had time out for bad behavior in the 3 years that we were married. We were probably apart more than we were together in those 3 years. But in 1971, I had a wonderful, beautiful daughter. We were in the process of getting a divorce. And I was going to move to, my parents lived in Spain at the time, and so I was going to move to Spain and be with my parents. And he called and asked if we could try it one more time. And I said, okay, fine. And I immediately got pregnant. And the fights immediately began, and it got pretty crazy. And we moved down to Southern California again. Lived with his aunt at the time. And how she started out her mornings was with her newspaper in her Manhattan. And that's when I learned that it was really okay to have that drink in the morning. Even though I didn't practice a drink in the morning because I was always so violently ill from the night before. But she showed me that it was really okay to have that drink in the morning with the morning newspaper instead of a cup of coffee. And life just got pretty crazy after that. And we moved back to Washington. I had that beautiful baby girl. And I left him as he was passed out in a chair, in a rocking chair, in May of that year, and moved to Georgia. I was always running away from me. Always running away from me. But in my mind, I rationalized and I justified all of that, that, well, I needed support so I could live with my parents and everything will be okay. And so I had to move. Court ordered me back to Washington State because he said he wanted to spend time with his daughter. So I moved back to Washington State and I lived in Seattle. And I went to work at a bank, and at the bank I worked as a drive-up teller, so actually you could only see from here up, which was a good thing for me. And one of these wonderful, because there was the Air Force and there was the Army that lived there, you know, and Navy didn't work, so let's try something different. And they would go through the drive-up, and I dated a couple of guys that were in the Air Force, but this one man in particular just stood out, and he was in the Army, so I thought, well, maybe this one might be different. And he was from California, and I always wanted to live back in California, but the problem that I didn't realize at the time was that he was just a raging drunk just like what I was. And so our biggest times were drunk times. And I used to drive and drink all the time. I had my favorite drink was Strawberry Hill Boone's Farm. You know, I didn't drink the wine that went, mine went, you know, and in the brown paper bag and was stuffed between my legs. And my daughter lived in the back seat. I had a 1961 Corvair Monza that one of those portable cribs fit just perfect. She was in a little cage in the back end of this thing. And she just lived back there because Mom always was in the car. Mom was always in the car. And you could open up our refrigerator door at any point in time and there would be two bottles of wine and two cans of chicken noodle soup. That's what she lived on. That's how we existed. The wine and the soup. The wine was for Mom and the soup was for Wendy. And life was pretty bizarre, but I didn't know it because it felt normal, it felt okay. This is the way that it was. So he had another girlfriend in Southern California, which I didn't know anything about. And He decided that at some point in time he was going to tell me about her, so I was all devastated and all broken and got rip-roaring drunk and got really crazy and said, okay, fine, I'm done with him. And he ended up moving back to California, ended up getting into an argument with her and called me up and asked me to marry him. And, you know, I said, yeah. What part of insanity is that? Yeah, pretty bizarre. So 3 weeks later, we got married. You know, it seemed like a good idea to do at the time. And it was within 3 days, I knew I'd made a horrible, horrible, horrible mistake. But 3 days. But I said, well, I'm in this one for life. And by God, I'm going to stay in this one. And so we began the battle, the war. It really began in earnest. And one time we had a discussion about having another child. Wendy at this time was almost two, and I said I didn't want to have him too far apart, and he said, I'm not ready, and I said, but I am, and so I just promptly went right down the toilet with all my birth control pills. Ah, seemed like a really good idea to do it at that. Am I stubborn? Am I rebellious? You bet. But it seemed like a really good idea to do at the time. Well, I did. I got pregnant right away. And life got pretty crazy. The battle was on and pursued, and so we ended up moving one more time back to Southern California. And he went to work for his parents, and I was the stay-at-home mom. And that's all I did was that I drank, and I stayed home. We fought, and life seemed like it was really rolling along pretty smooth. And what happened was that somewhere along the line, I got crazier and crazier and crazier, and I attempted numerous suicides. I wanted out. I would get drunk and attempt one more time. And at one period of time, it was so bad that I used to save up pain pills. That was the easy way out, was the medication. I didn't want to slit my wrist. No, that was too gory, and it hurt too bad. Was not into physical pain. So I attempted suicide, and he called my parents. They were living in Japan at this time. And my mother flew home. And it was pretty awful for her to have to come home from Japan to see her daughter in the state that her daughter was in. It was pretty horrendous for her. And she stayed for a little while and made me promise that I'd never, ever, ever, ever do it again. And about 5 years later, she had to come home one more time because I tried it one more time. And this time I wrote one of those really long letters. And it seemed like the real logical thing to do at the time because I needed to be the center of attention. It was always about me. And he was involved in a wedding, and all I got to do was stick the cassette tape in and turn it on. So I was nothing, and he was everything. Talk about a resentment? You bet. So one more time, my parents had to come, and my mother came, and she helped me, and life was just pretty crazy. I had these two kids, and they were getting crazier and crazier, and my son was acting out more and more and more, and the doctor kept trying to say, well, he's got a hyperactivity problem. Well, you'd have a hyperactivity problem, too, if you lived at home with who he was living at home with. Two people where he never knew for sure what was going to go on. And in 1986, my daughter was 15 and a half, and my son was 13, had just turned 13. My daughter was replaying the pattern of my life. And what I didn't know was that she was using drugs also at the time. And life was pretty crazy in that household. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody was talking. And we were all living with the elephant in the living room. And nobody would talk about the elephant. It didn't exist. It wasn't there. And we were just existing. And in 1986, Wendy began to threaten suicide, so I thought, well, what do I do here? So I called a therapist that I knew, which I had been in therapy ever since, at some point, since I was 13. They never could quite figure it out. I was a raging alcoholic at 13 before I even drank. And so I put Wendy in one of those facilities. They call it a youth lockdown ward. And she ended up there, and we began talking about some of the things that were going on in the household. And the whole time, everybody was doing this. It was him. He was the problem. Get rid of him, and everything will be okay. And in the meantime, I'm just being this good little person, you know. All of these times I attempted suicide, all these times I was raging around the house, it was always him. Everybody in the household was pointing at him. And in October of 1986, life got really, really crazy. And he was physically violent, and it seemed like the normal thing. We'd end up in an argument, end up making up, and he'd buy me something really neat so I could be bought. I had no clue until after I sobered up that I was really prostituting myself. But in October, what happened was that he approached me one more time about having this liaison with somebody else, and I lost it. On my insides, I just felt as if there was no way that I could, I couldn't go on. I just couldn't go on. Couldn't go on with the way things were. And I was scared, one more time, that I was going to have to do something really drastic to me. Because I just wanted out. I could not. The pain was just too intense. And what I want to describe to you is my very last drunk. I went into a real fancy place, Shakey's Pizza Parlor. I was playing baseball. I was very physically active and playing sports. And, of course, he was the coach. And there was 9 other women that I was in constant competition with for him in my own mind. This was just in my own mind. And we lost another baseball game, and we were all commiserating about the loss of this baseball game. And so I had been trying to control and enjoy my drinking, and the controlling part was, the enjoying was lousy. And so I went in for a glass of white wine. That's all I went for. That's all I was going to drink. And so somewhere around the 5th or 6th glass of a glass of white wine, somebody said, you know, Cindy, it'd be really a whole lot cheaper if you'd just buy it by the carafe. And I said, no, all I want is a glass. All I want is a glass. That's all I wanted. But what I had done that I didn't know that I had done was that I had crossed over that invisible line. At that point, I had crossed over it before, but I didn't realize that the drink had taken me. And I actually drank myself sober that night. I could not get enough booze in my body to make anything go away. It's the only reason why I drank, was to make everything go away. Then I could live, then I could breathe. I love that. I've heard people talk about it from the podium, and when they had that drink, it was the that's all I ever wanted, is to be in that place. If I could just get there, then everything would be okay. Well, I always fell off the edge. Always fell off the edge. I was also violently ill. Every time I drank, I got violently ill. I heard somebody share the other day in a meeting, and I thought, oh, my God, I had forgotten that. I was told by my ex-mother-in-law that if the bed is spinning, you take your foot and put it out. I said, that'd be fine, except I sleep in a waterbed. I can't get my foot down. So I'd end up sleeping alongside of the porcelain goddess. I would spend my nights curled up, huddled up against the toilet because, oh, that floor felt good. It was wonderful. Everybody left me alone because somebody would open up the door and I'd go, go away and leave me alone! And they'd close the door. He would throw pillows at me. I'd throw them back. I slept in the bathroom, always violently ill. But on that night, I didn't get violently ill. And I had all this booze. And I started driving people home because I was the only sober one. Well, that night, this lady that played on this baseball team, and she used to walk around with these funny grins on her face. I mean, she had the smile. And that's the way she looked all the time. She just grinned and just was happy and said, she used to say some real weird stuff like, this too shall pass. And I'd go, what? She got really, I mean, she was strange. Good baseball player, so we kept her on. You know, and the funny thing is she didn't drink. That was even stranger, because we all drank. So on that particular night, she came up to me and she said, "Hey, Cindy, I just want to let you know that if you need anything, I'll be available." And I thought, available for what? Available for me? Why would you be available for me? Didn't make sense. That was on a Thursday night, and I normally drank over the weekend, but I didn't drink on Friday. I didn't drink on Saturday. I really didn't drink on Sunday. It just kind of amazed me. And on Monday morning, he woke up, and I woke up, and started getting the kids off to school, and got them off to school, and he approached me about this threesome that he wanted to do, and I lost it. And he trotted his little tush off to work, and I just was crazy. And I started washing wallpaper in the bathroom. And this wallpaper, every time you'd wash it, some of the color would come off. And it kept fading and fading, and kind of related it to that's how I was feeling on my insides, that it just something wasn't right. There was something wrong. And I remembered those words that lady said. So I picked up the phone and I dialed that number, and she answered it. And I said, "I don't know what's going on, but I really need you." She said, she asked this stupid question. "Are you going to drink?" Why would I drink? Didn't compute. She said, "Well, I'll be there in about a half an hour." So she came over and she 12-stepped me. I had no clue that that's what she was really doing. She talked to me, and I talked to her, and she talked to me, and I talked, and I talked, and I talked, and I talked, and she would listen, and we drove down to, she said at one point in time, "Why don't you go for a ride with me?" So I went on down to the San Fernando Valley, which was where their central office was, and we went into the central office, and there, behind this desk, was this little old man. And he had that same look on his face that she had on her face, you know, that grin. "Hi, how can I help you?" And I thought, another one. And I walked up to the desk and I asked him a very profound question. "Hi, do you have any literature about Al-Anon?" And I thought, oh, yeah, right. And he just looked at me and he goes, "No, but I can get you their phone number." So he gave me the phone number for that other 12-step organization, and I called that, and because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that it wasn't me who had the problem, it was him, there was absolutely no way that I could be the drunk. Absolutely not. No way. Well, after that lady took me on home, she approached me, she got right in my face. This earnestness, she got sober in New York. Hardcore. And she got real close to my face, about that close, and she put her finger in my face, and she said, "Cindy, do you think you have a problem with booze?" And I just stood there and said, "Maybe. Probably. I guess so." And she said, "Good. Now that that's over with," she said, "if you ever drink again, I'm going to stab you." The word I left out, I can't repeat. And I believed her. She said, "I just would put you out of your misery, because obviously you're a miserable drunk. And obviously you're trying to kill yourself the slow way, and I'll just do it easy and quicker for you. So remember this, you can't drink, okay? Fine, no big deal, I won't drink, okay?" That's how I felt in my mind. I had no clue that I had the disease of alcoholism. I had no clue that my problem was that I couldn't stay stopped, because I was a periodic drunk. I could drink occasionally. There were times when I wouldn't drink, you know, 3-4 days, a week at the most. But I always came up with a reason to drink. Well, he's mad, so I'll drink. The kids are having a hard time in school, so I'll drink. Well, I started going to that other 12-step fellowship, and staying dry and following this woman around. I actually, she'd get up in the morning and I'd be sitting on her couch. And she'd go, "Oh God, are you here again?" And so I began doing a lot of work at that period of time. And I didn't do AA. I didn't attend any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, 2 weeks dry, nothing in my system, restless, irritable, and discontent. I was shaking on my insides. And he announced that he was going to go out and get drunk. And I lost it. The rage came out one more time. And as he was driving away, I was chasing him down the street. That seemed like the real sane thing to do. And as he stopped at the stop sign, I put a couple of big dents in the back end of his Porsche. I thought that was a really good idea to do at the time, too. And I thought, what have I done? I went back in and I called that lady, and she said, "Don't you suppose it's about time you went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, I don't have anything left to share with you then." She just cut off my lifeline. She just separated me from everything that I was breathing in and out for. And I said, "Okay, I'll go." So I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And it was in a room real small, probably about the size of the woman's bathroom. It seemed that small, probably a little bigger than that, but I have a tendency to exaggerate, too. Shrink and grow large. And it was a tag meeting. And at that meeting, there were a lot of people sitting around a table, and then they had lots of chairs sitting around the outer edge. And we got there late, of course. And there was a couple of chairs left, and they were in the corner, back up against the corner. And I thought, "Oh, good, perfect spot, okay." So I went over and I sat in the corner, and I'd been in enough meetings where I knew what a tag meeting was after I had gone on a little bit, that I knew you don't look up. Whatever you do, you don't look up. That's it. Bottom line, don't look up. So I sat there with my head down and just didn't look up, you know, kind of went like this every once in a while to see who was talking and looked back down. And then I made the big mistake of looking up, really up. Maybe something struck me, I don't know. And the person on the other end in the other corner said, "How about you back there?" And I went, "Me?" He goes, "Yeah, you." And what happened for me that night was the fact that the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "My name is Cindy and I'm an alcoholic." Started crying. And I couldn't quit. And I blubbered then the rest of the meeting. And the people in the meeting room that night came over and gave me a hug and said, "Welcome home." And then I went to another meeting that night. And I began to attend one meeting a week of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I needed it or not, for the next 60 days. But I heard enough in that meeting to know that I needed to do more meetings than one meeting a week. But it was a woman's meeting, and I was scared to death of you guys. I didn't want anything to do with you because I felt that I was so attracted to men, period, that I would do something really stupid. Really, really stupid. So I went to that woman's meeting. And at that woman's meeting, there were a lot of women there that had a lot of long-term sobriety. In fact, there was a woman there who had, like, I think she had 10 or 11 years of sobriety. And she was quite a crack-up, and I thought she was an arrogant you-know-what. I didn't want anything to do with her. She spoke the truth, and she spoke it firmly, and she spoke it with love. But I'd heard enough in that meeting to know that I needed to do more meetings. And at 60 days sober, I lost it on a Sunday morning, and I went to a meeting at a place called the Rafters in Newhall, California. And it was, they had over 33 meetings a week at that one clubhouse, one group. And I'd heard enough about the group to know that, okay, you know, it's an all right group. And so I went to that meeting at 9:30 Sunday morning, and I sat there and I was figuring out, they didn't give out chips at this other meeting that I went to, the one a week that I was going to, but they did at the Rafters. And I was sitting there figuring out wait a second, I've been sober for how long now? And all of a sudden, it dawned on me, I'd been sober for 60 days that day. blew me away. So when they asked for people, I raised my hand for 60 days. I got this little green chip. And as I got this green chip, I looked across the table from me, and there sat a man that I knew. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he stuck out his hand, and he said, "It's so good to see you here." And that's the way that it's been for me. This guy came around and hugged me, and I knew I was home. And I started doing at least 4 or 5 meetings a week there, and I was doing noon meetings, and then I started doing night meetings, because the night meetings seemed to be one of those meetings where you could hide in. But I also knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I had an ego, and I still do, as big of all outdoors. And I was so profound in my speaking. And I had this great message to carry at 60 days sober, and I began to spout it. And people would just go, "Oh my God, get that kid to shut up." And what happened was that I began to switch meetings, and I began to sit in this meeting with this one gentleman who, at the time, I think he had 32 years sober. And he sat at the end of the table, like these tables here. They were in long rows, 3-4 tables. And he sat at the end of the table with his chair propped back on the chair, his hat tipped back, and his black leather vest. And he would say things like, "If you've got less than a year's sobriety, sit down, shut up. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. You ain't got a thing I want to hear." And I thought, okay. And I began to haul that lady that I called my sponsor to those meetings. She didn't do a whole lot of meetings. She'd been 10 years sober and kind of moved away from the program, but yet did a whole lot of 12-step work. She carried the message, it carried people to meetings, and then she just kind of disappeared out of the scene. And that's basically what ended up happening, is that I ended up doing a lot of meetings. She did a lot of great work with me. I did my very first inventory with her when I was less than 90 days sober. I began doing the work that needed to be done so that I didn't drink again. And I heard enough in those meetings to know that I had to become actively involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that was important. So secretly, I began cleaning up the tables. Secretly, I began wiping down the tables, cleaning up the ashtrays, dumping the trash, sweeping the floor. I began to do all of that stuff, but I always did it on the sly. And then what happened for me was that there was a few other women in these meetings, and I began to spend some time with them. And this other 12-step fellowship, I began to spend quite a bit of time with the ladies there. And this one lady that I asked if she'd be my other sponsor. And at that time, that's one of the reasons why I started doing a lot of meetings, is that she said she didn't sponsor women who were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who did not do as many meetings of AA as they were doing of the other one. And I thought, I'm dead. Because I was doing the other one at least one a day. So I began to pick up 2 meetings a day. One of one and one of the other. And I began slowly to move away from the other 12-step group, which I'm grateful for the gifts that I was given there, because it helped me out a lot. And life got pretty strange and pretty crazy and pretty bizarre. I was sober, but not doing a whole lot of other things, but just doing that work. And my very last, my New Year's, I was somewhere between 60 and 90 days sober, and I went to one of those plain old whoopee parties. And my sponsor didn't recommend that I go to this whoopee party, but I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that if I didn't go to this whoopee party, that he would find somebody else at this whoopee party, and he wouldn't bother to come home. So I went to this plain old whoopee party, and at that whoopee party, 5 minutes before midnight, he walked up to me with a glass of champagne, put it in my hand, and said, "You might as well drink this, because this is our last New Year's together." And at that point, I looked back at him, and I handed him back the glass, and I said, "I don't care whether it's our last New Year's together or not. I don't have to get drunk because of you." And I walked away. And I became the designated driver that night and began to really have a good time. And 8 days later, we were separated. What I didn't know was that he was dating my best friend. Which happened a lot in the course of our being together. And every time he would have one of these girls on the side, I would end up getting beat up as he ended the relationship. I would catch it. And what happened in the course of all of this was that he moved out, and when I went to take my 90-day chip, I went to a special meeting that night and went to take my 90-day chip. My son, who was 13 at the time, came up to me and he said, "Mom, where are you going Tuesday night?" I said, "Well, I'm going to the rafters, my normal place." I was began doing the things, telling my kids that I was going to be at meetings, and I went to meetings and came home and I said I was going to come home. They didn't know what to think about this. They were a little confused, a whole lot confused. And he said, "Well, Mom, can I go with you?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." Ego, duh. My son wants to see me take my 90-day chip. Duh. I said, "Well, what do you want to go for?" He said, "Well, because I want to get my 30-day chip." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, you're not an alcoholic." And he just looked at me and he goes, I went, "Oh, I'm going to eat those words. Who am I to say you are or you aren't?" And so we started going to meetings together, my buddy Jason and I. We had a great time together. And yet, at that period of time, I met my old-timer. Yes. Mr. Jerry. He had 2.5 years of sobriety and I had 90 days. And we started dating. And one of the things that old-timer had said was the fact that you need to make sobriety your number one priority. And if it's not your number one priority, you got no business doing anything. But for God's sakes, get involved in a relationship because it'll make you either go or grow. And he was true. It was true. But Alcoholics Anonymous became my number one. It was number one in my life. I began doing things that I never thought I could do. I filled out a clearance form for Tehachapi State Prison, and I started going to the men's prison twice a month. It was great. I did that for my first 4 years of sobriety. I also began going to Acton Rehab. I got my own panel at a young men's facility, a camp, juvenile camp. And the young men that were there were from 13 to 19. And I went probably for about 4 months, and all of a sudden life got really crazy in my household. My 16-year-old daughter got picked up for shoplifting and cocaine possession. And life was pretty bizarre in that household for that first year. It was nuts. It was crazy. But I gave that panel up because what I felt like I was doing was that I was carrying the disease more than I was carrying the message. So I really stayed very actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jerry and I got married on my one-year anniversary. I had a 3-tier birthday cake. I love it. Grandiosity to the max. You bet. After we said our vows, his sponsor, which was his best man, my Al-Anon sponsor, which was my maid of honor, and Jerry's other sponsor, Jerry, married us. We had an AA wedding. We got married at the Southern California Convention in 1987. And the only two non-alcoholics or non-program people there were my parents. And after we said I do, Lou grabbed a hold of my arm, took me back to the back table where the wedding cake was, and stuck my one-year birthday candle in there. And everybody sang happy birthday to me. That, for me, just blew me away. I started crying, and I think I cried for 3 hours after that. I couldn't believe that I'd actually made it a whole year sober. And in the meantime, my daughter had moved out. She didn't want to live with me anymore, so she moved to Washington State to be with her natural father, which was a good thing. But in January of 1988, I get that unexpected phone call, 10 o'clock in the morning, or 10 o'clock at night. We were already in bed, and it was, "Hello, Burbank Airport, flight number 99. 11 o'clock tomorrow night, be there. She's on the plane." What happened? I picked the phone back up, and he had started drinking again. And he just ripped me apart, and I hung up the phone. She came home. She lasted for about 2 weeks, and I said, on her 17th birthday, which was January the 29th, I handed her the keys to the car, $1,500 cash, and said, "I love you, but you're on your own." And that was through sponsorship that I got through that. And she moved out She lived within the same community. She stayed sober for a while. And she moved off the hill, and we lived in Big Bear, California at the time. She moved off the hill, moved down into L.A., got a job, got an apartment, got her life pretty well together, but then I watched her live in an apartment, live in her car, live in an apartment, live in her car, live in an apartment, you know, and all this time it's like, okay, fine. Well, she finally made it to 18, and we threw a big party. Yes! Now I didn't have to be responsible for her anymore. No, if she would have messed up, guess who would have fallen back on? Me. I prayed my tush off for that year. And in the meantime, Jason was still sober. He'd been sober for this period of time, and he ended up, we moved again, and he ended up quitting school at 17, and he got involved with her, and they got pregnant right away, and they had babies and more babies and more babies and more babies, and in the meantime, and they have four. And in the meantime, in 1991, Jerry applied for school in Kansas City, was accepted into the school. That's his story. And so we got to leave Southern California and move to Kansas City, Missouri. And at that point, we had walked away from two grandbabies and family, friends, and everything. And what I also ended up doing was that I walked away from my sponsor. She had moved, I had moved, and we had lost contact, and I got pretty crazy. He was in school. I felt like I had absolutely no support. But I had enough AA in me where I began to know that I needed to really plug myself back into the program really deeply again. But I also knew that within 2 years we were probably leaving the Kansas City area, so there was no way that I could get involved in the areas that I really wanted to get involved in. And I started going to a lot of meetings, and I began to sponsor a lot of women again. And life began to kind of calm down a little bit, and then we moved to Salina, Kansas. And who would ever have thunk it that I would have made it from L.A. to Salina, Kansas? And Salina was quite a jolt for me. I mean, when you come from L.A. to a place where there's 50,000 people, maybe. It's on good days. And in my arrogance, I began to tell them how they were supposed to do AA. This is the way we did it in L.A. This is the way you need to do it here. And got pretty ostracized from the AA community. And made life pretty miserable for a lot of people around me. And I began to decide what I was going to do with my life. What am I going to do when I grow up? And I had absolutely no clue what I was going to do when I grow up. I'm still back. I'm back in that phase again. I'm back in school again. But I think I could become a professional student. As my sponsor informed me the other day, it's time for you to get a real job. I said, a real job? She goes, yeah, you get a real job now. Oh, okay, I get a real job. But what ended up happening was that I ended up going back to school, and it took me 4 years. And in January of 2000, I became an ordained minister. And my life was pretty bizarre, but I felt really, really good about what was going on in my life. I began to totally devote a lot of my time, a lot of my attention to a lot of different things. And in 1999, my sponsor that I had, I began to get a pretty structured sponsor, and in 1999, my sponsor died of cancer. And I knew better than to go without a sponsor again, so I immediately got another sponsor and began working with this other sponsor right away. And we're still developing a relationship today. But I left Salina, Kansas, and moved to Omaha. And I'm still, in fact, I'm more actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous now than what I've been in a long time. I go to York Prison. I go to Douglas County Jail, Sarpy County Jail, Pottawatomie County Jail. I do all of those things. As what Jim said this morning, I started doing all of those things that I did in my early sobriety. Because I know that even though it's been a while since I drank, I'm just as close to that next drunk. If I don't keep active participating in my own sobriety. I want to thank the girls that I sponsor for coming here today. In fact, one came all the way from Salina. And I'm very, very grateful for them in my life. They have no clue in this last year how much they've given me. And this last year has been probably one of the hardest of my sobriety. Not only losing my sponsor, developing a relationship with my other sponsor, But my son ended up divorcing that woman that he'd been married to. She got pretty heavily, actively involved in her own addiction, and my grandchildren were taken out of the home and placed in protective foster care. And I couldn't see him when I wanted to see him. I couldn't talk to him when I wanted to talk to him. I couldn't do all of those things as a grandma that I felt was, by God, it's my right. And I got very righteous. And thank God for sponsorship, because that sponsor kept telling me, they're not your children. They're not your grandchildren. They're God's kids. It's none of your business. Your only job is to love them. So I would drive to Salina. I would take my 2-hour visit, monitored, supervised, videoed, audioed, all of those things, sign my life away, and I would get to spend 2 hours, 2 glorious hours with these little kids. And what happened was that my son ended up going out on a really bad methamphetamine run. And he ended up with 6 felonies and 2 misdemeanors. And, you know, the gift of this program is the fact that my only job was not to say, how dare you? What's the matter with you? My only job to say was, God, I love you. I'm so sorry. It's so hard. And they ended up giving him probation. Duh, I'm going, wait a minute, this can't happen. This just can't happen. So he ended up with probation. He's on like 4 years of probation. Well, actually, it's 18 months until he pays his fines, and when his fines are paid, then he's off probation. But the judge did inform him that if he messes up once, one dirty UA, one not being to work, one whatever, not doing what your probation officer says, Mr. Holliday, you will spend 4 years incarcerated. And so he's doing that stuff. He's not telling me what he's doing, but he's telling Jerry what he's doing. You see, I'm busybody mom. I'm learning how to keep my mouth shut. I'm learning how to do all of those things. Well, last Wednesday, they went back to court for the discharge of the children. They've been out of the home for over a year to decide what they're going to do with these grandkids. And the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is the fact that I didn't have to be in the courtroom, that I could turn it over to God and say, okay, God, whatever this is your deal, not my deal. And because those two kids have decided that they're going to change their lives and they've begun rebuilding their life and doing all of the things that they were asked to do, those kids are going home. And I'm so grateful. You people have helped me keep it together long enough to see that happen. I mean, without you, without the girls that I sponsor, without my sponsor, that wouldn't have happened. Not that way. I would have been stuck in the middle of it somewhere trying to create some chaos. But that's not what happened. I'd like to say that I'm in a great relationship with my 30-year-old daughter. She's not talking to me. She's living on the streets of Las Vegas. Please, pray for her. It's interesting to me how this disease just wipes out everything. She emailed me. She goes to the public library and uses her email. I'm going, God, only an addict and an alcoholic would do shit like that, you know? Amazes me. I go, she doesn't have an address, but she's got an email address. She doesn't have a car, but she can make it to the library. No, and she emailed me not too long ago, and she said, Mom, you know, I lost it all. I didn't think it would happen to me, but I don't have a problem. That's the disease of alcoholism. That's the disease of drug addiction. I'm so very grateful for you people, so very grateful that my life is what it is today. I have the best life that I ever thought possible to have. There's absolutely no way that from Los Angeles, California to Omaha, Nebraska, could I be doing the work that I'm doing? That I could be doing the job that I'm doing. I work for a large health system as a chaplain. That's not possible. But it's possible. And I get to work with drunks. That's even more unheard of for me. And I also get to spend time with a lot of other people who are in deep distress. But you see, without this program, without the God of my understanding, without you people, without all the things that I'm doing, I wouldn't be as effective for them as what I could. The idea of all of this just absolutely baffles me. They actually, people that I spend time with will actually bring gifts back to the department for me. I'm going, do they have any clue? They have no clue. I have a key ring at home that has this funny looking key on it. It's the key to the fourth floor of Emmanuel Hospital. Do they have any clue who has a key to the fourth floor of Emmanuel? I'm going, I don't think they have a clue. But that to me is what the gifts of sobriety have given me. They've given me a life. They've given me a family. They've given me a fellowship. They've given me, without you people, without this program, without any, I wouldn't be here today. I would be dead. And I wouldn't have the people that I have today in my life that mean everything to me. It's amazing, utterly amazing, the gratitude that I have for the life that I live and for the people that I have. And Jerry and I have had our trials and tribulations in our relationship. In fact, there was a period of time when I was not sponsored that we were going to end up getting divorced. And thank God for sponsorship. Thank God I reached out and began to get some direction in my life. And that woman saved my marriage. And I began to do the things that she told me that I needed to do, even though I didn't want to do them. They didn't make sense. Smile at him. Okay. Treat him lovingly and with respect. All right. Tell him that you love him. Walk away from an argument. You don't have to be right. I began to do all of those things, and I'm very, very grateful. I can't tell you how grateful I really am for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, for all of you people. And I really want to, again, thank the committee for asking me to speak. And truly, I wish you all continued years of sobriety and the wonderful gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. God bless you.